Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 353. Nerds TV show on BBC America this weekend is a tribute to space with Buzz Aldrin and Babak Ferdowsi, who, by the way, I cannot tell you what it was like watching Matt Myra meet Buzz Aldrin. I mean, it was obviously incredible to meet Buzz Aldrin just for myself, but watching the experience of Matt, like, I mean, if you listen to the podcast with any regularity, you know what NASA and the space program mean to Myra, and so it was kind of a beautiful moment. It's fun to watch Myra get a little emotional. So he's got a chewy center, Myra. He's all soft and gooey inside, and Buzz was great. So that's a Nerdist TV show, BBC America, 10/9 Central. I don't know what number BBC is on your channel, but channel numbers are irrelevant now anyway. You're going to pick it on your programming guide, look up Nerdist or BBC America, or maybe it'll come up under my name. Also, speaking of podcasts that have morphed into television shows, Marin is Mark Marin's show. It's a semi-fictionalized account of Mark's life. It's based on true thing. It actually, I just want to say I'm glad that it didn't say based on true events. Although it kind of would have been funny in his case if they had done that. There's an all new episode this Friday, 10 p.m. on IFC, and it's sort of like there's a podcast shell around the show, but there really is just like stories, like a lot of stuff that Mark's talked about on the podcast that then sort of became what the show is about. And people like Judd Hirsch and Gina Gershon and Aubrey Plaza and Adam Scott and Dennis Leary, Sally Kellerman, Josh Brenner, really fantastic guests. And Mark, congratulations to you, Mark Maron, for getting your show on the air. And I've been reading a lot of great reviews for it, so people seem to love it. And so if you haven't seen it yet, you should absolutely check it out. Maron, Fridays, 10/9 Central, IFC. High fives, Maron. High fives. This episode is W. Kamau Bell, who I knew from San Francisco, not that I'm from San Francisco, but performed in San Francisco a lot. Fantastic comic who landed a show on IFC called Totally Biased, which is a really fun comedy, almost sort of a social experiment show. And it is on, it returns, new episodes return May 9th at 11 on FX. But in the fall, the show's going to daily. It's weekly right now, but then the show's going to daily. And I never really had the opportunity to sit down and talk to him at length. And so, again, besides creating content that you mash into your ears and listen to as you go about your day, the podcast is also fun for me because not only do I get to catch up with people that I haven't hung out with in a long time, but I also get to know people that I've always kind of like, oh, that guy seems cool, but I never really had a conversation with him. So it's, you know, it's been a good reason to actually just sit down and talk to people. And so if you're not familiar with Kamau, or you're not familiar with Totally Biased, just check out that show, but also check out his comedy and just get to know him. So here's the Nerdist Podcast episode number 353 with W. Kamau Bell.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Testing. You sound good. We sound all right.
All right.
I think this is going to work.
All right.
I'm very excited about this. Thank you for having me up to your office. It's sort of, it feels up here like people have been gone for a little bit and they've just come back. So there's a lot of, it looks like
It looks like coming back after there's been a summer vacation. Like, oh, I just threw a bunch of stuff. Oh, thank you very much. I piled some stuff here, and I moved that thing over there, and where did I put all of the things?
It's also a function of me not knowing how to have an office. So it sort of looks like my room when I was 13. Just things are sort of piled on top of things.
Is it weird to have an office?
Yeah, it is weird to have an office. It's totally weird to have an office.
I mean, you're in it now, man. You are in it.
Yeah!
You are in it.
For a little while, for at least 142 episodes.
Try not to think about it that way.
I know, that's what they when they said it that way. I was like, I can't stop thinking about it that way.
Because your first thought is, yay! And then your second thought is, I have to make 142 episodes of television.
Yeah.
What am I going to talk about?
Every day for a while, or most days of the week, I guess is the best way to
Certainly there can't be enough in the socio-political sphere to cover 100, I think it's like 130.
Yeah.
And then just 12 fluff episodes.
Yes, yes.
12, like, jerk-off tips.
Exactly,
or
yes.
Whatever.
Yes. 12 episodes about, we'll have shows where I just do, like, Oprah, my favorite thing. Look under your seats. There's nothing there because we don't have that budget.
My favorite thing is nothing. My favorite thing is disappointment.
Yeah, sleep. Don't you love sleep, everybody? Let's all take a nap.
And then just an hour of television where everyone's napping.
Yes.
That
yes.
feels like a show that would be in Japan. It's just like an afternoon nap show.
Yes, yes.
Where you just watch a bunch of attractive Japanese women sleeping.
Yes.
And then, like, a weird guy, an older, avuncular gentleman just quietly whispering to everyone. That's a Japanese television show.
I feel like
show.
I've seen some of those clips online, but maybe that's too revealing.
Super refreshing nap time.
Super refreshing nap time, yes. I know I've seen that show. Japanese television, that actually is what it is, which it feels like we're making fun of it, but...
No, it really, that's totally a show.
At least that's a big aspect of it.
I'll tell you what, I would be surprised if that's not already been done, to be honest with you.
I'm sure it's a segment on a show that also has people tripping and falling and getting hit by things.
Well, you know, in England, they had, the Big Brother channel.
Yes. Oh, yeah, where you watch the Big Brother house 24 hours a day.
And a lot of times you're just watching them sleep.
Yeah, yeah. And then sometimes you watch them do things that they had to go to jail over, I think. Did that happen?
Yeah, I don't know.
there were some things happened that weren't supposed to happen.
Well, you trap a bunch of people in a house for a while, and then you stick some cameras in there, and some shit's going to go down. And the producers know that.
Yes.
And it's bad for humanity, but it's great for television.
Well, it's funny. MTV just reran the original Real World series.
The original one?
The original, yeah.
Like Norm and Eric Neese and
yes,
Julie?
Yes, yes. They just reran it a couple months ago.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And it's funny to think how different it was. There was a lot of not stuff happening. There was a lot of just people in a house hanging out.
They didn't know what they were doing. It was enough just to show people living their lives before they realized, television needs conflict.
Yeah, before they started taking sticks and just poking them.
Poking them. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone's going to have to shoot guns at each other. What?
Before they got, we need to get a Nazi supremacist and a black militant to really make this work. it's not enough to get a white person and a black person. We need the extreme.
Because this is the real world. Those two people would live together
in a
house.
And they all need to be working in a smoothie shop.
That's they have to work in a smoothie shop and then do some sort of, we have to paint over graffiti in the afternoon.
Yes.
I mean, it's totally the real world. During the day, you're like, fuck you, you're white. Fuck you, you're black. Now let's go to a bar. And then it's like, then they go out.
A very well-lit bar.
Yeah. And then they dance their differences away until they're hungover the next morning and argue about who left the cereal open.
Exactly. The real world.
That's it. That's exactly how the real world works.
That's how it works around here.
Well, I guess it's true. When you're in college, you don't really get to pick your roommate.
That's true, yes. And often they will put a black militant with a white supremacist.
You don't know. And maybe it's a part of some grander conspiracy to get people to understand each other. Although I doubt that we're that organized.
Yeah, isn't that called the world?
I think that is just called...
Isn't that called civilization, a grand conspiracy to get us all to get bigger, we can all get along better?
How long have you been out of San Francisco? Have you been out forever? Or?
No, I left, went for this show. I left San Francisco 6 months ago, or last June, so whatever that is.
So, for people who don't know, Kumail is sort of a staple of San Francisco comedy. you don't have to say it, but I can say it.
It's funny, because that sometimes has sounded like an insult, but now it doesn't anymore.
No, it's not.
I have a job.
Well, I'll tell you what. It sounds like an insult if you're in San Francisco still,
and
you haven't been working for a long time. This guy is a staple of San Francisco comedy.
Yes. Somebody said legendary San Francisco comedian the other day. I was like, oh, thank God I don't live there anymore. Because that I've heard many comics get upset being called legendary in San Francisco.
Well, because there are some guys who are still there.
San Francisco is like a, it's like, you know how every 70s television show had quicksand?
Yeah.
San Francisco is quicksand. Like, it will slowly pull you under and you don't, and it's a great place to be, but it will get its talent, it will slowly pull you down.
I
just gave the quicksand talents for a second and I decided not to do that.
It's a great comedy town, but the upside and the downside is that per capita there's more literacy. People listen, they're mm-hmm. great audiences. Mm-hmm. You can make the kinds of references that you can't always make in other parts of the country.
Yes.
And so that feels really nice.
Yes.
But then you go to other cities and you're like, oh, not every city is like San Francisco to perform in.
No. And I think that sometimes in San Francisco, and I know this of a lot of people, you sort of get all like San Francisco, like, I'm just going to go back to San Francisco because that's where it's supposed, that's where they're smart. Blah, blah, blah.
Safe.
But then you also can't make a living. Right. You know, I mean, I made a living, but I did a lot of things to put food on the table, you know. And they were all like, I wrote my one-man show out there because I was like, I can't make a living just as a stand-up in this town. And I don't want to go on the road because I'd been on the road a little bit. And it just was like, I can't, you know, it's the thing where I don't think I do that. Like, it's that weird thing, like, I want to, what I do isn't necessarily what works 30 minutes feature spot in Tennessee.
Either, right, right. You know?
I can get it to work, but it doesn't. But it's not exactly the best version of what I do.
Well, San Francisco is it's just, you know, I've done SF Sketchfest for the last, I think, 8 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a town where people will come see a comedy show in a science center.
Yes. And they actually would rather see it there than in a comedy club.
Yeah.
They would actually rather, there's something about comedy clubs are just like, I wouldn't do that. Like, a lot of my audience who I supports me in San Francisco has never been to the Punchline or
Oh, comms. Really?
Yeah. I have a lot of audience. That's the thing that's great about San Francisco. If you sort of get out of the club system, you can find an audience of people who think clubs are uncool, but will come see you in a science center or in an art gallery or, you know, in the back of a bar or at a theater. You know, like that, right. That would never come to a comedy club because that's...
I love Cobbs. There's just something about the Punchline, though, that it's, you know, I understand why Chappelle pretty much just performs there when he's in town because it's so, you're just in it with the people. And Cobbs is awesome if you can fill it.
Yeah. If you can fill it is the big part of it. Yes.
But you can still have 200 people in Cobbs and it's like, the room's empty. Yeah. You know, but Punch is like, you get 200 people in there and it's a fucking...
Some of them are standing.
Yeah.
You know, so the waitstaff can't make it around. The Punchline, it's like an old school comedy club. You know, I mean, it's funny to think that used to be considered a big comedy club, 175, but now that's like an intimate space where, I've seen Chappelle do 3 hours there, you know, many times. I used to open for him a lot because I was like one of the last guys in town who sort of he knew and that the club trusted, and you know, so I was there with him a lot of times.
I got to open for him once or twice because I think I was supposed to be headlining a Thursday night or something, and then he had one of those things where each night he would do a show and then just tell Molly, who was running the Punchline at the time, who I adore, he would just say, okay, I'm going to come back tomorrow night.
Yes,
and they would release tickets and it would sell out like that.
Yeah.
And so she was like, is it okay if Chappelle performs tonight, headlines instead of you? I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Of course. And so I ended up getting to open for him and I watched him do like, oh my God, it must have been like 4 hours.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it was.
And I know it sounds long, but for some reason, when you're watching him, it doesn't feel like 4 hours.
No, one time I saw him do a set that was 5 hours long. People literally left at daybreak, like the sun was coming up. And I can't imagine a more tight 5-hour set, which isn't to say that it was laughs all the way through, because that's impossible, but he kept the ball up in the air for 5 hours. And there would be some valleys, but he would bring it back up every time.
I learned something from him that I feel like I started implementing instantly, which was... just because of the way he does these longer shows, it's very much a dialogue with the audience. Mm-hmm. It's very conversational, and he just starts talking, and then out of that, they'll respond, and then somehow he either weaves into pre-written bits, or he weaves, or things just come out as bits.
Yeah.
But it just feels like a conversation with Dave Chappelle as opposed to I just saw a comic do a bunch of time.
Well, it's funny. I remember because I started really working with him a lot right after he got back from South Africa after the whole Comedy Central thing. And it was funny to see how it evolved over time because when he came back from South Africa at first, it was like an hour and a half of just like brand new... I've been in South Africa thinking about all this stuff, and I'm here to bring it back to the people. And then at the end of about an hour and a half, 2 hours in, he would go, what do you guys want to talk about? And that would be then the next 2 hours, which is sort of be him talking to the audience. And then it became such an insular thing where the following nights he would talk about things that had happened the previous nights.
Yeah.
You know, like there was a guy here last night who had a laugh like the Green Goblin, and then that becomes a bit. You see that bit get bigger over
time.
And then over
the next couple of days, you see bits really start to solidify. Mm-hmm. Like they get exponentially better each night.
Yes. And then eventually, like, he's not doing any... Now it's like he wasn't doing any of the hour and a half he wrote. It was just all about the act of being in this place, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really... You know, and they taped all of it. Someday, I don't know if it's going to happen. I feel like Chappelle's going to be like Tupac and Jimi Hendrix, where forever, every 2 years, there's going to be a new Chappelle album that comes out from, like...
Oh, my God.
Because they taped all of it. They taped all of it, you know, at least for that 2 years or so.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
He has a responsibility.
He's sitting on, I feel like... the hour and a half he came back from South Africa with it was one of the best hour and a half of comedy I've ever seen in my life, and he's sitting on it. You know, it's just like, because a lot of it was a little bit about Comedy Central, but also about the nature of being a celebrity, and it was, I mean, you know, I was like, it was, people who think they know him as a comic don't know him if they didn't see that.
Well, that's, I think that seemed to be what might have been frustrating to him, is that he actually has a lot of really poignant things to say,
yeah.
And he would go perform and people would shout out, I'm Rick James, bitch.
Yeah,
and
it's like, yeah.
On the one hand, you go, okay, well, it's great that because they, you know, that show mm-hmm. got people out to see him. But on mm-hmm. the other hand, I don't think he was mentally prepared for that, and he just wanted to be a comic. He just wanted people to listen to him.
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, even through getting, you know, me working on Totally Biased, I sort of said to a couple people, it's funny that a lot of us become comics, if not all of us, because we don't want to work a day job.
Right.
And then if you really get good at it and get lucky, you get a day job.
Yeah, and he says behind his desk.
Yes, as I sit behind my desk. Yeah, it's like funny to think that if you're really good and you have some opportunities come your way, you get a day job.
Yay!
And it's that thing where suddenly, I don't understand what Dave Chappelle went through, but I certainly get that there's this whole thing where you're in the middle of this, like, oh, this is totally not what I was prepared for, you know?
Well, and I also think that the idea that, you know, a lot of the stuff that he was tackling, a lot of the race stuff that he was tackling on Chappelle's show, that he noticed, oh, the wrong people are laughing at this for the mm-hmm. wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, a lot of the...
Once you give it away, it's gone.
The
audience decides how they're going to take it. It's like, you know, I would imagine that the guy who invented the hammer is like, I didn't mean for people to hit people in the head with it.
No,
you know,
like, it was supposed to
build houses, yes. And to make, yeah. But once you give it away, it's gone. And so I think that's hard for, you know, that's a hard thing to get wrap your head around sometimes.
The atomic bomb, I just made it because I wanted to create big mushroom art.
Exactly. Yeah.
I had no idea people were going to...
I had no idea.
Oh, no!
Oh, no!
No!
Yes.
But I wonder, do you find that... Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that take that the wrong people can take your stuff and sort of use it in a way that you didn't intend?
Yeah, I think that's probably 40% of what goes on Twitter. Just people taking your stuff and doing something with it that you didn't intend. And I think it's sort of, I think every, if I can call stand-up comics artists for a second.
Sure.
I think it's every artist's responsibility to decide how they deal with that. Like, I totally understand some people being like, well, I don't care. I'm just going to do what I do, and I don't care what happens with it. For me, it's like, I'm really going to work hard to make sure you can't do anything wrong with it. Like, that doesn't mean you can't do something wrong with it, but I'm really going to try to craft the thing into such a thing that it sort of can only accomplish the goal I want it to accomplish.
Which is very challenging because particularly the kind of stuff that you do, which is sort of challenging socially, I wonder... How are you able to do that? That seems like an extra layer where you're like, okay, it's hard enough to write the material.
Yes.
Now I want to put corks on all the spikes so that people can't stab each other.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that, you know, the goal is still gut-busting laughter, and I think that's, you know, and I think every sometimes people ask me that question. I feel like every comic has rules that they abide by. Like, I mean, Jim Gaffigan is making it a little harder on himself by not swearing or not talking about naughty business.
Right.
But he's sort of, you know, you can't say Jim Gaffigan's not one of the funniest comics. You know, Brian Regan is doing the same. I think everybody has these rules. I think, but when your rules seem to be somehow pulling for the forces of good, people think more of your rules. Like, they sort of, you know what I mean? Like, we all sit down and go, I'm sure there's things you're like, I'm not going to write jokes about this.
Right.
Just because, for whatever reason. But you probably have funny things to say about that, but you're like, I'm just not going to do that. But I think somehow, when you're perceived as being political, as I've been perceived, or somehow, I don't know, trying to make the world a better place, as I'm sometimes perceived, which I'm not saying that's not the case, but I still, the goal is still gut-busting laughter, and we're all playing it, we all have rules in which we accomplish that.
Isn't it interesting that what social media has done to comedy, you know, again, good and bad. Good, oh, you get to, you know, send this message out to a large number of people. But then what you realize is, oh, fuck, comedy is not really intended to be for an audience that large.
No.
You know, it's an intimate experience.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you were to expand that room of 200 people to 2 million people, a percentage of them are going to hate you. A percentage of them are not going to agree with you. A percentage of them are going to be really offended no matter what you say, because inside most comedy is a seed of something that's offensive to someone.
Yeah, if it's not hurting somebody's feelings, it's probably not that funny. And like, I just think it's somebody's got to be like, hey!
Hey, I love that.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, what I think is what you find is that you go, oh yeah, comedy was never, I mean, like, you wouldn't stand on a mountain and project your voice for 2 million people.
No.
A lot of them would not appreciate it at all and tell you to go fuck yourself.
Yes. Well, and I think that that's, you know, like, I just read an article yesterday about the Australian comedy festival. I forget what it's called, but anyway, Tracy Morgan was there. Tracy Morgan did a couple shows. Apparently, people walked out because they found it offensive, and it's like, man. Didn't you read that article from 2 years ago?
What did they think they were going to see?
They think they're going to see Tracy Jordan.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
As written by Tina Fey. You
know. Now, that's also an interesting point, too. And certainly, I think the advantage to what you're doing, which is your show is your point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So if people watch that show and they go see you live and they still go, hey, I'm offended. It's like, well, fuck you. That's your fault.
Because
you knew exactly. I kind of understand the disconnect of people thinking, you know, like when Patton was on King of Queens with Tracy on Dirty Rock, you know, that people might go, oh, I thought it, fuck, because TV's real life.
They think it's, but I mean, even with me, like, I've gone out since the show's gone out and I've done some shows, you know, I certainly, there's a harder edge in the stand-up there isn't totally biased currently. Like, in stand-up, I think I dig in a little bit more than I've dug in. I'm totally biased, because I think there's still that thing on TV where you're trying to present it in a way. Then in stand-up, it can become more personal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can sort of be like, this is my... right now, like, the episode Totally Biased, there is a sense of, like, I'm trying to speak for a bigger group sometimes.
Yeah.
But on stage, I'm speaking for myself a lot of the time. So...
Oh, that's... Okay, that's
I can be a little bit more... I can be a little more... I can hold opinions that I know are wrong.
On stage, you can.
Yeah, I can sort of be like, I know that's wrong, but this is the way I'm going to say it. This is the way I feel about it today, you know. Whereas in Totally Biased, in the last 19 episodes, because I'm still learning how to do it and figure it out, I really am like, okay, let me just try to make sure that I can defend this thing on Twitter later. You know, in stand-up, there's kind of like, I remember Chappelle said this years ago when he came back, and I was with me, he's like, dare to say something you don't believe. Which I think there's an aspect of doing stand-up where you want to sort of get, as I say, get over your skis and get ahead of yourself, because you might find something interesting that you didn't know you were going to say. So just let your lips go a little bit, like, sort of like,
right.
And then you might find something that's like, wow, that's really not something I ever expected to say, but yay! And I feel like that's what Louis C.K. does a lot. Like, he sort of allows himself to sort of talk ahead of his brain. And I don't mean that. I think he just...
I know what,
like,
you mean.
Yeah. And then he gets to a place that's really interesting artistically that may not be defendable in a court of law. You know what I mean? But it's a really sort of... But as a stand-up, I think that's what we're sort of going for, is to be in a place that's funny and interesting, especially with the voices of a million stand-up comics out there.
Yeah.
The one way you can distinguish yourself is by not sort of editing yourself.
Right. And I think also with stand-up, there are ways that you can nuance your words so that you can say something really awful, but then people know, like,
yes.
Okay, you don't mean it, or...
Well, you've built up enough credit with them over the course of your performance that they know. It's like if your friend says something awful, you don't judge your friend.
Right.
You're like, oh, that's Billy. You know what I mean? And I feel like, as a stand-up, if you build up a relationship with the audience, you get those moments, too.
Well, I think, and particularly, I think the credit that Louis has built up is that he's incredibly human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what people accept about the horrible thing he says. Like, yeah, he said a horrible thing,
yeah.
But I've said horrible things, yes. And I've thought horrible things because we're people, and that's
And it's fun to hear somebody say them out loud.
It's fun to hear somebody say them out loud. It's fun to watch, to see someone admit that they're as selfish as I can be.
Yes, yes.
And own it.
Yeah, and so I feel like with me now, with my act, I'm almost, I think because of Totally Biased, maybe it's becoming a little more personal because there's so much of Totally Biased that's like about the world. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that now it's like there's a lot about, my act is becoming a lot more about me maybe. Because I have plenty of time to talk about the world, and I'll have a lot more time once we go to 5 days a week in the fall.
I know, that's going to be crazy. I mean, like crazy in a good way, but also crazy in a, you won't really have time to second guess anything, and it might be a little more challenging to be like, can I defend this on Twitter?
Well, yeah,
you don't fucking have time.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I think that there's been examples of how to do it right, certainly by Jon Stewart and by Stephen Colbert, of how to do it. But they, I mean, you can, as a comic, you watch those shows, you're like, there's a lot of work in that. There's a, you know, there's,
oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, like yeah. Solid jokes every few seconds.
Yes, yes.
For, you know, 4 days a week or mm-hmm. whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, solid jokes, and also from a perspective that seems consistent. You know, because we can all write jokes that aren't from a consistent perspective, but from a consistent perspective. So, you know, yeah, I can't really tell anybody how it's going to work out. We'll all know in a few months.
Well, as long as you allow yourself to experiment, you'll figure it out. I mean, you'll just adapt.
Yeah.
Because you have a comics brain, and I think one of the muscles that we strengthen more than most professions is that we know kind of how to adapt to a room.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, like, okay, this isn't going to work, that's going to work, it's this kind of crowd, okay, I'll just play this. I'll do more crowd. You know, like, you'll figure it out.
And I think also, you know, we have a lot of comic brains out there, too, and I think that right now, over the next 7 episodes, and FX has been really big on this, is telling us to experiment, and like, sort of like, don't think whatever we think the show is now is the show. So we're going to use the next 7 episodes to really push the idea of the show and really try to invent some new ways to do the show, whether it's more comics correspondence or field pieces with different people, to sort of still figure it out. Because I think that we're not, unlike those other shows, we're not really a parody of the news or anything, so we can sort of do whatever we want to do.
Yeah.
You know?
And how would you describe, like, in your head, philosophically, what do you think the show is? Or what do you think what is your mission statement?
You know, what is the mission? That's a good question. I should probably have this written down. you know, it's funny. I certainly feel like that. You know, it's funny because the way you start talking about this stuff, especially with this kind of show, I don't know. Maybe a comic starts talking about their comic, you can't help but feel like. The bit of comics are talking about their comedy, you can't feel like, let me explain how my comedy is changing the world. I start to feel stupid. I really do feel like when I think of the image of the show, I think of, like, I was talking about this, like, because there's different ad campaigns that the show is doing. It's like, I really want to do an ad campaign where it's like a hot tub. And there's just a lots of different types of people in the... I feel like I'm creating a room and a space for everybody for all the people who feel unincluded by mainstream society to be included. You know what I mean? And that comes from being living in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Like, so I feel like I want to create a space for people who don't have a voice to have their voice. You know what I'm saying? And I think that a comedic space, for example, like, so I feel like the more, when I feel the show's doing the thing it's supposed to do, it's when I feel like there's things in the show giving voice to people who wouldn't have that voice anywhere else on television, you know? So that's what I feel like the show is. And sometimes that's my voice, and sometimes that's the writer's voice, and sometimes that's people on the street's voice, you know?
Yeah.
So that would be I'll have to edit that down a little bit into 140 characters. But that's the mission statement of the show, is like allowing people who don't have an opportunity to have their voice on TV, have their voice on television. And when we do that, I feel like we're successful. Like when we had we did a thing in the last six episodes. I feel like the last six episodes are the best representation of that. We had a thing where when Barack Obama mentioned Stonewall during the inauguration, as being one of the big civil rights moments of American history, along with the you know, the bus boycotts from Alabama, and he mentioned Stonewall, and Guy Branum, who's a writer on the show,
I know Guy.
Yeah, he's right.
He's out there. He's great.
Yes, he's absolutely great. His idea was to have a drag queen come on and talk about Stonewall, and I felt like that's not going to happen anywhere else. Yeah. Where the joke, you'll see a drag queen on its show, but the joke is that it's a drag queen. You know, right. Like that's, and with us, it was like, no, the joke was what the drag queen is saying.
Yeah,
and it also was putting forth a political viewpoint. I felt like, to me, standing on stage while that was happening, because I just sort of was off to the left watching it and watching the audience and watching Sherry Vine do it, I was like, this feels like something that's not happening anywhere else. And so for me, when the show is doing things that we're not doing our version of the Daily Show, we're doing our own show, that's when it's the best, you know.
Yeah.
We have a piece right now that's sort of making its way around the internet for the second time of women talking about being catcalled on the streets, and it was just me on the streets talking to women about being catcalled. And it's, you know, women talk about that amongst themselves a lot, but it doesn't happen in mainstream media. And it was funny. It wasn't just women complaining. They were funny. I was funny. We did funny things with it. And it's going around again because I think this week was International Street Harassment Week. Against street harassment. Yes, yes.
Hey, nice tits. What? It's international. Oh, did I get that wrong? Oh shit.
We should really rename this.
I'm sorry, yeah. Your tits are awful. Oh, I fucked it up again. Oh, what am I supposed to say? I don't know what I'm supposed to say.
Nothing.
Wait, I'm supposed to say nothing?
Yeah,
I'm just supposed to not talk.
Yeah.
So I'm supposed to not yell at strangers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I live in America. Yeah.
That might be San Francisco. This is New York.
Yeah, it is New York. it's San Francisco too, but it's definitely New York. So.
How has the media been describing the show? Is it? Do you kind of put your head in your hands if they're like, it's like the Daily Show, but with a black guy talking about blah 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 blah?
It's funny. I kind of understand. The more I go through with this, the I sort of understand people's need to catalog it that way, because I feel like that's the first step into people taking it into their heart as something they like.
And then it'll become its own thing.
But they have to sort of like, what is it? And so I feel like if they go, I don't know what this is, then they're not like, then they can't take it in. So right. I feel like, so Black Daily Show, you know, first of all, the Daily Show is doing what the Daily Show does, so I don't think there needs to be a Black Daily Show.
But it's also not, because it feels like, you know, the Daily Show is very, it's politics.
Yes.
It's skewering politics. And your show drifts into that some, but then it's also like, but it's, there's the social aspect too, and just people.
Yeah.
It's like social politics.
Well, that's, to me, like when I describe my act, I think of it as social, I do say socio-political, because it's like, sometimes culture is political.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it's not, but I feel like it's that, like the first, I'd say our first 13 episodes, because they were sort of mostly during the election, we probably did feel more like the Black Daily Show, because we were talking about Barack Obama versus Mitt Romney, and I was supporting Barack Obama, clearly. And then after that, I feel like we've really drifted away from that in a great way.
Yeah.
And I think the reviews have reflected that. I think it was the New Yorker that said our gimmick was intersectional progressivism.
Wow. That sounds like a very New Yorker phrase.
Yeah, it is. And I was like, I think I know what that means. And then I'm like, okay, yeah. And I feel like that's actually, and when I, once I Googled all those phrases and put them together, that is what our gimmick is that we sort of, it's progressive politics sometimes beats only one drum at a time, and we're trying to beat all the drums at the same time.
Right.
You know? So I think that's when it works its best, when it's like, I sort of feel like it's, sometimes you, in the Bay Area, you'll walk into a place, and you'll see a little bit of everybody in that room, and like, man, everybody, like, you know, there's lesbians over there, there's gay guys over there, people who support immigrant rights over here, and there's a Sikh over here, and I feel like that's the room I'm trying to create, you know. So, yeah, in that sense, then it doesn't look anything like The Daily Show. It looks like our show.
I'm curious, what's the delineation between, I mean, then this is for any cultural heritage, what is the delineation between, you know, of being responsible to recognize your cultural heritage and wanting to be identified for that, but then also at the same time going, yeah, but then I don't want to be identified. You know, like, this is a roundabout, it's a dumb question that I'm asking.
No. There are no dumb questions.
Okay, so as a black performer.
Yes.
if someone says, oh, he's a black comic, you go, why'd you have to say that? Why didn't you just call me a comic? And other times where you go, no, I am a black comic, and I want to own that part of my heritage. For, you know what I mean?
Well, I think in anybody who's sort of in the other category in America, which is like, you know, if you're black, it's weirdly women are sort of an other, even though they're most of the population. Gay, could be religion, could be Jewish if you're in the wrong room sometimes or another. So you have to sort of, you have to reconcile what that means. And so for me, I get, the moment I step on stage, I'm a black comic. The moment I step on stage, and then it's up to me to sort of decide, how do I want to play into that or subvert that?
Right.
And so, and I think the thing you have to be aware of it. Like, I was just in South Dakota, I was saying before this, for a baptism. And, you know, I didn't see a black person the whole time I was there. And I was aware of it. You know, like, I wasn't, like, I was like, the whole time I was like, I haven't seen a black person the whole time. And so that means I'm the only black person, which means these people aren't around a lot of black people, which means I am taking up a space that they are unfamiliar with. And I have to sort of be aware of that, you know. And some people, it might not change their behavior at all. It just means that I need to be aware that that means something here. You know, whereas if I walk outside in New York, I'm not the only black person on this block.
You're just a guy.
I'm still a black guy, but I'm not the only black guy. Which I think there's a big difference.
Did you find in South Dakota that you feel like there was a responsibility to be, you're like, hello, everyone.
I think in general, as a black guy in America, when I enter a situation where I'm the only black person, there's a little bit of a sort of just be aware of the space you take up, especially as a 6'4" black guy.
Yeah.
Like, be aware of the space you take up. Like, for example, my wife is white, and we joke, but we're half serious about, like, if we're in a situation where we need to return something at a store, I go, you know what? This is a job for a white lady. It's just like, because if I do it, I automatically sound angry. You know what I mean? Or there's a tendency to think that maybe, what's going on here, black guy?
You've
returning
got to
thing?
Do a segment on that on your show.
Oh, it's coming.
You've got to do it. You yeah. return something, and then your yeah. wife returns yes, something, yes. and then you see what the reaction
yeah,
is.
Yeah, we call it trading privileges.
I mean, the closest that I've ever felt to that. You know, obviously there are 300 million white people in America, so yes. if you're white, you probably feel pretty like, oh, hey, what's the problem, everyone?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the closest that I have felt to that is going to Europe and being American, yes. or even Montreal and being American, but mm-hmm. but more so Europe, where, you know, when you say American and you instantly, in a few places I was in, sort of felt this cold shoulder. It's like, oh, now I'm the American guy. What did I do? Yes. I didn't do anything, yes. you know, but all of a sudden I represent this whole cultural ideal that they have. Mm-hmm. This cultural idea that they have in their head of what that means, and yes. there's nothing I can do about it.
Well, it's funny. Like, I did the Edinburgh Festival 2 years ago. You know, have you ever done that?
No, because I haven't. I just haven't. I know some people
say... You don't have
time
for that.
I know some people say, like, you can only do it for 2 weeks, but I think if you're going to do it, you should do it for the full month.
Well, no, I think I would agree with that. You might as well get all the way beaten down. you can't really judge how beaten down you are in 2 weeks. But yeah, it's a big commitment. So I did that, and it was funny to read reviews, you know, and to find out how American people thought I was, and it wasn't about black, although it was about black American. You know, like, there's this weird thing about, like, that they have an idea that they were sort of disinterested in my Americanness.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't the black thing. It was like, oh, this American talking yeah. about all this race stuff. We don't have any of that over here. Oh, really? Tottenham's burning down because a black guy got killed by a cop. You know, so... But it was really weird to sort of take up that American space. And then they have to sort of subvert that space. You know, sort of have to feel like, you know, oh, you guys hate America? Hey, I'm from America. I have the information you don't have.
Right.
I have it from the front lines, you know. So it is funny to take up that space. But then also behind that, have to hold the black, still holding the black thing. You know?
Yeah. This is kind of a side note. Did you see the interview with Samuel Jackson and the guy and the kid who was interviewing him?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and he was like,
Django,
the N-word. Say it. If you can't say it.
We're not going to talk about it.
Should the kid have said it? And if he did, would it have been okay?
Well, here's the thing. I don't speak for all black people, so so I can't necessarily say would he have been okay. Certainly, if he had said it, some aspect of people would have been mad, black, white, and all colors in between. I think they both handled that awesomely.
I think they did too.
I think
the kid did the right thing.
I think he did the right thing too, because I think he knew he was being baited, and there's no reason to take that bait.
No. You know?
I think he even handled it in a way I thought that was really sensitive. You
he
know?
Was such a sweet kid.
Yeah.
No, sorry,
yeah.
I can't.
I don't want to say it.
And say it!
Yeah, exactly.
Which, the sweeter he got, the more aggressive Sam Jackson got.
And I don't think, who knows what Sam Jackson wanted. Sam Jackson probably would have loved it if he said it anyway, just because it would have been, Sam Jackson clearly likes to just have experience. But I thought that dude handled it well, and I think white people can learn a lot from that. I think it should be like a white training film. Just because you can say it doesn't mean you should say it.
Well, Chappelle's had this amazing bit about, he said he had a white friend who was really comfortable saying it when they were just hanging out with each other, like it was okay.
Yeah.
But then he'd go into a room and then he would say it, and then Chappelle would be like, "This motherfucker's great." Like,
yeah. Yes. No, it's. I think the people I have a bit that I've been doing now about how I was in San Francisco and two different white people within about 5 minutes of each other said the word nigger to me, and not calling me that, but it's, I don't really draw that distinction, you know, because if we're not in, the whole bit is about, like, look, you may have people in your life that you can say that word with,
right?
But that doesn't mean you can say it with every black person,
right?
You know, as the joke is, we don't have the black people meeting anymore where we decide which white people can say the word nigger and which can't.
Well,
we haven't had that meeting since '68.
I'm from the South, and so what I would hear white people say is like, oh, it's okay for them to say it, but not okay for me to say it, and I always go, yeah. Because it's their experience.
Yes.
It's like, you can't... I can talk about my mom.
Yes.
You can't talk about my mom.
Yes.
So that's a very easy thing to understand.
Well, it's also the thing, too, is that you actually can say it. You just have to deal with the consequences. There's nobody stopping you from saying it. You just then have to deal with the consequences. You can do whatever you want to do in America. Literally, whatever you want to do. It's just some things come with consequences.
Please make that a... There's a bit in there somewhere, man. In there somewhere. If you're talking about that in your act, there's a bit in there of like, you can say it.
Yeah, say it.
Just know that this is going to happen.
Yeah, there's different levels of words.
Yeah, that's fun. I think there's a bit
in there. I did a show recently in a... college that after I got there found out it was a Christian college, and I didn't know it was.
Oh, those are the best when you show up and they're like, okay, so could you not say and yeah. Like, why didn't someone tell me this before? I just flew 1,000 miles.
Yes, I would have liked to have had an opinion on this. and I called my my manager because I was like, oh yeah, this is a Christian, like I saw like a Bible quote on a wall and I was like, And the thing that keyed me off, it wasn't one of the, as I say in my act, it wasn't one of the top 10 Bible quotes. You know, there's those Bible quotes where you're like, do unto others, yeah, we can all agree with
exactly.
That.
Ah, the footprints parable. Okay, yeah. That's on every.
But then there's that level where it's like, 2 Corinthians.
That's a pretty deep level of Corinthians.
Yeah. That's an album 2 cut.
That's a deep
side
cut.
2. Yeah, it's a deep cut of the Bible.
That's a B-side.
Yeah, it's a
B-side.
That's
a Bible B-side.
Yeah. And I called my manager, and I was like, they don't want you to swear. And I was like, all right, but I can not swear for the night, but do they know I say the word nigger like 19 times in my act? And she's like, oh, they're fine with that. Oh.
They are?
Really? Oh, well, just like Jesus would be, I guess. Yes. Again, I just thought it was funny, like, that's fine.
You're referring, of course, to Anglo-white Jesus with blue eyes and golden locks of hair.
And abs.
Yeah. It's ripped.
Yeah, just like Jesus would be. Yeah, I thought it was funny, like, to me, like, where people draw that distinction. You know?
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Is Chris Rock one of the producers of your show?
He's executive producer, one of the executive producers of Totally Biased.
And Chuck Sklar.
Yes, who's also right over there.
Chuck Sklar, I gotta say hi to him. I subletted an apartment from that guy.
Oh, that's funny.
During September 11th.
Oh, well.
I moved out here because I was supposed to go back and forth to LA, and then that happened. And I was like, I think I might not want to travel back and forth every other week. So someone hooked me up with Chuck. I'm like, oh, there's a comic named Chuck. He's got a place like in Soho.
Ah.
And I subletted his apartment for like 6 months.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's right here. He doesn't have that apartment anymore. But yeah, he's got a house in LA that we're all sort of, for a while, we're just temporarily stationed here.
Right.
And now that the show's been picked up for 135 more episodes, we're all moving here.
That's true.
In one level or another.
Let's be honest, you'll really just have enough time to go sleep.
Hopefully. Hopefully. I got a daughter. I'd like to see her get older.
You might have to just bring her here and let her hang out.
Well, she does come to the tapings. She's come to most of the tapings of the show, which is great just to have her around.
How old is she?
She's almost 2. She'll be 2 May 25th.
Adorable.
Yeah, she is.
And all of the things that you're saying, she's absorbing all.
Well, it's
of it.
Funny. The other night, I did a show in Oakland at the New Parish, and she came. My wife and they, because the show's at 7, so like she goes to bed at like 8:30. So we're like, oh, she can come, and she'll just go to bed a little later. And so she came to the show, and she was like the VIP section, which is right over the stage, so I can sort of hear her over my head as I was doing my act. And Maya said she paid attention to a lot of it. Sometimes she did cartwheels, because that's what a two-year-old does. Like, time to do cartwheels, time to draw. And then afterwards, it was funny. Like, people were telling me that, like, there was times where she was really paying attention, and she would repeat what I said. And there was times where she was, like, just watching. And then afterwards, my wife was like, what do you think about Daddy's work? What were the people doing? And she'd clap. And then she'd, like, what else are they doing? She would laugh. So she was clearly taking it in and realizing that Daddy was making people clap and
laugh.
You're
going to get a phone call when she starts preschool and like, your daughter said the N-word 19 times.
No! And see, I'm the dad who'd be like, well, tell me what was going on.
Sam Jackson there? Did
yeah,
he make
yeah.
the same?
There may be a reason. I'm not saying that there is a reason, but I need to know the circumstances before I get mad.
What was the W. Kamau Bell Curve show?
Yes.
What was the... Because from what I read...
Mm-hmm.
This show was the Totally Biased was sort of Chris Rock saw that show.
Yes.
And I know you were touring that show for a long time. So what mm-hmm. what was that show?
Well, it's funny because when I first met you, what was it? It was like 10 years ago or something.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, and I met you. I was part time managing the Punchline because I was trying to find a way out of comedy.
Are you serious?
Yeah, when I met you, I was
why?
Like,
why did you
want to
get out?
Because I had banged my head up against the wall, and I was like, I just don't know how to make what I want.
How long have you been doing it at that point?
4 or 5 years or so. Yeah. So like at a point where I was like, felt like I'd seen lots of my peers sort of like, you know, and people. It's the point where you see people behind you pass you by that you're like, huh. I don't think I'm doing this correctly.
Yeah, well, okay, so just the timeline of that. So 10 years and then 5 years beyond that. So, mm-hmm. like, 97, 98. By that mm-hmm. point, you would have seen, like... well, Dana Gould was a little before.
He's before, yeah, by the time I got there.
But, you know, the Pattons and the Brian, the Posehns.
Yeah, no, when I moved there, those people had just moved, shipped out of town. So when I was there, Arge was, like, one of the kings
Arge Barker,
of town.
Yeah.
But, like, I'd say, you know, it's funny, the guy who, Al Madrigal was a guy who started a little bit after me and then was gone. Like, you know, like, and then he was just suddenly like, oh, Al's going to be famous soon, you know? Al got a ticket for fame. And so I was a part of it, but then a class of people started after me that was like Moshe Kasher, Brent Weinbach, Jasper Redd, Louis Katz, and a lot of those dudes were gone fairly quickly. And so I ended up being like, I got to figure out a way around this. I don't know how to do this. And so out of some frustration, I decided to... I had been working in the solo porn community in San Francisco, directing and actually teaching people how to do it because I had sort of gotten through... I met a guy who had a solo show. He knew I was a comic. We hung out one time. I saw his solo show, and he was like, I'm having problems with it. And just because I had a comic's mind, I was like, well, I think you should move this part here because you're not in this part. Take out because it's distracting. And so I started directing his show. And then he recommended me to other people, so I was directing other people's shows. And at some point, I got really frustrated with, like, I was sort of telling people, do what you believe, do what's on your heart, you gotta be out there and really say things you're afraid people will be offended by, you know, all this stuff. And then I'm going at night going to the Punchline. You ever notice how men sometimes...
But that's what's so... you know, you're so lucky that you had that experience, because I think the biggest challenge sometimes with comedy, I think, is how to get out of your head for a minute.
Yeah.
And so they gave you the ability to get out of your own head and say things that you just never would have thought to yourself.
I never would have thought if people weren't standing there waiting for me to say things. So, and then I decided to... I sort of basically... The idea behind the Bell Curve was like, I want to write the show that I think I would do if I was famous.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Like, that was basically like, what would I be doing if I was famous? What would the show be? And I would be like, well, it'd be... At that point, I was like, well, it'd be about racism in America. I would use video clips and slides, and I would create slides and video clips. And it would be... And I was like, okay, it'd be an hour-long show. And then the title sort of hit me at one point. Like, I had all these different titles for it. It's like, wait, The Bell Curve, the book that said black people can't learn. Oh, my last name's Bell. Ah! And so it was the W. Kamau Bell Curve, ending racism in about an hour. And, And I said about an hour because I didn't think I'd have an hour of material. So I was like, well, if I do 45, that's enough. But the first
it doesn't
night.
Even matter. It just sounds funnier.
It does sound funny. But then eventually, it ended up being that I had every night was over an hour because I just had so much stuff. And I was so it was so fun to be in an environment where there was an audience of people who were just like, we're just here for you to do what you do. And I sort of got to stretch out and really find new bits and find new ways of talking about things and be more courageous with the subjects I chose. And And out of that came the... Eventually, I got a director, my friend Martha Reinberg, who I met through solo performance, and we sort of tightened it up into this, like, it could be anywhere from, like, an hour 20 to 45 minutes, depending upon how we did it. And that became the W.K. Bell Curve, and I took it to the Comedy Central stage in L.A. several times. Paul Stein directed it there a bunch of times, and then directed it in New York, and brought it here to the Fringe Festival here, brought it to the Nova Festival, took it to the Edinburgh Fringe, and just started basically taking it around to colleges, sort of, and... You know, it was just a hour-long show that was about... That was always very topical, so it taught me how to write topically very quickly. Like, I would have to do whatever racism stuff was in the news, and because Barack Obama was running for president, there was a lot of racism stuff in the news. And then also there would be personal stories from my life about racism that were sort of longer form, but still had the spine of stand-up comedy in them. And, you know, it became a thing I did in San Francisco for, like... I started in 2007... And basically did it for a year and a half straight, once a week, twice a week, three times a week. And out of that, I was able to do it other places.
Well, yeah, and if you're doing it that much for a year and a half, then the show just gets super tight.
No, it was funny. I did it, yeah, because I did it for like, I did a 3-month run three times a week, and that's the most I'd ever performed at that point ever. Like, you know, because even if you're doing, I wasn't headlining at that point, but even if you're headlining, you're doing an hour, three nights a week. But it was like, this is like an hour and a half, 3 days a week. You know, really digging in. And
well, and in San Francisco is a little bit like LA in the sense that, and New York too, where it's you're not going to get to do an hour every night.
No, yes,
like,
yeah,
you can
yeah,
do
yeah.
You'll do like, oh, you get 10 minutes, yes, you know, yes. Here and there.
Tonight you can do 15. You know, like, so yeah, so I really got a lot of stage time and got a lot of support from the community. And it wasn't, a lot of people hear comics doing a one-man show or doing a solo show, and like, oh, he's just going to tell his jokes slower. but for me, it was like, I was really like, there was a big audio-visual component to it that other people didn't have and weren't expecting, and that when people came and saw it, they're like, oh, this isn't that thing.
Yeah.
And so it already, I think when Chris saw it, it already kind of looked like TV a little bit. You know, sloppy TV, but certainly like, oh, he's got a screen, and he's talking to the screen, and he's showing clips, and he's engaging with the audience, and it's topical. So I think Chris could see, like, oh, if this guy had a TV show, he already knows how to write topically. He's got a fit, he's got a perspective, and he thought it was funny enough. You know, like, I think it was just like, in his mind, it was just like, those things make TV.
Yeah.
You know? So I did it at the UCB Theater, and... He just happened to, he had been told about it from Chuck and from another woman named Jocelyn Cooper, but he floated in after the show started apparently, and then after I didn't know he was there, and after I finished, he came backstage, and it was just like, oh.
It's probably good you didn't know he was there.
Yeah, you know, people say that, and I think it is good. He knows, I've talked to this before, he knows he's a Jedi of comedy, you know, like he knows that his presence alters the environment, you know, so I think he knew enough to come in late, you know,
yeah.
or come in after the lights went down.
Oh my God, oh, I remember hearing stories from Louis C.K. about Chris Rock teaching him stuff about comedy.
Yes.
That were... of just like simple things where you go, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe I shouldn't be listening to music on the way to a show. I should be thinking about what I'm going to be talking about on stage.
Well, no, yeah, Chris is really like, I think the one thing about being around the show is that he comes to, I think we've had 19 tapings and he's come to like 18 of them.
Oh my God.
And the one he wasn't at, he actually watched on a closed circuit feed and then called when he had advice or suggestions. He pitches jokes, but he's really a much As much as people think he's a great comic, he's got an even better comedy mind than people realize.
at what point did you get comfortable going, I don't know if that joke's going to work, when Chris Rock pitches a joke?
We've done 19 episodes, I'd say the 19th episode.
They were finally like, I don't know!
It's funny, there was this moment, and everybody sort of laughed when it happened. It was when Oscar Pistorius, that story broke about sprinter. And Chris was just, because sometimes he can just dig in, he was just going off. And he had all these jokes about it and all these things. And I just, like, I used one or two of them, and then he just kept going, because he just was like, he was on a roll, basically. And after he finished at one point, I was like, I look forward to seeing those jokes in your next special. And the whole room sort of exploded in laughter, because it was like that scene in Goodfellas, like, ah, look, spider! And he luckily didn't shoot me. But then the next time I talked to him, he's like, he actually was very complimentary. He's like, yeah, he's like, you're running the show, you got it now. He's like, yesterday I pitched 5 jokes, you took 2 of them and told me the other 3 were bullshit Chris Rock jokes, and he went on. You know, so he wants to see that. He doesn't want to feel like he has to be around.
Well,
so.
Yeah, and also, you know, if he's a comic, if he's a real comic, then he... he doesn't want you to patronize him. He understands that not every joke is going to work.
Or not every joke is going to work for me. You know, I think that's the one thing that I think we're learning. I'm learning with this process is like being able to go, that's a good joke, but I can't say that joke. Or I don't want to say that joke. You know, so, yeah, no, he's been a great... Forget the television show. If Chris had just been in my life like this for the last 7 or 8 months... Without the TV show, it would be beneficial. If I was paying him like a monthly fee to just come around and be in my life and help with comedy, it's been beneficial.
I mean, it's you know, it's certainly a luxury problem, but I'm sure frustrating as a comic where it's like people don't necessarily allow someone at his level to just workshop material.
You mean hit
on stage?
He does that.
He'll go up with like a notebook and just start doing jokes and and sort of like
No, but he likes being around the writers and he likes being in the room and riffing stuff out, and you know he likes the like he always said that his goal was to be a comedy writer, and the only way he knew how to become a comedy writer was to be a stand up.
Oh wow!
Yeah, which is just a funny thing to think that he just because he didn't come up. It's funny to think that if Chris Rock had ended up at Harvard, he would just be a producer. You know, like,
he'd be producing,
like, you know, maybe he'd be producing Saturday Night Live or something. But yeah, that his goal was to be a comedy writer. But at his where he was and who he was, oh, you got to be a comic to be a comedy writer. Yeah.
So what do you when you? Well, it's going to all change now when you go to a daily format.
It sure is.
But how much of the stuff that you come up with on the show do you kind of have baskets in your head where you go, that's a stand-up joke, this works for the TV show, this might actually work for both? Like, do you... Because your stuff is topical, how much do you want to cycle through
material? Generally, like, one thing Chris said early on is, like, don't save anything. Don't feel like you're saving something for something else. Put it all into the show. So that's generally my point of view is, like, I sort of first go, will this work for the show? And if I go... for a lot of times, if it's really personal, I just sort of put it in stand-up. Mm-hmm. Like, but generally, if it's... about something that's happening right now, I'm like, this is for the show, you know. So right now the baskets are just I sort of want to squeeze everything into the show, and then if it doesn't fit in there, we'll put it in somewhere else.
Do you still have stand-up? Will you still have stand-up energy once the Daily Show starts?
I don't know. I mean, it's funny. I think about the Daily Show. You don't... I mean, I hear that Stewart does stand-up occasionally, like at colleges, but you don't hear about like those guys, like, I mean, Stewart's a stand-up, but yeah, I feel like you don't hear about those people doing stand-up tours, so I'm sort of like, am I about to retire from stand-up comedy? Like,
well, especially if you have a family, if you're working all week, like, and someone goes, hey, do you want to fly across country on a Saturday?
No.
I kind of want to sleep in. Yeah, kind of want to spend time with my kid.
No, I it depends on what the hiatuses are like, but I certainly, you know, I feel like I'm going to say the thing that I hear everybody say. I'm always going to be a stand-up comic. I feel like I've heard Ellen DeGeneres say that.
Right.
And then they go, I just don't have the time or the energy.
Really, the only guy that I ever really believe is Louis. Because he's, you know, even when he was working on Conan or writing for Chris, like, he would still sneak out and do a set and then come back to work.
Yeah, I think but I think he's now in the position where he's been able to design his schedule such that, like, he took a year off from his FX show.
Yeah.
So he could do stand-up. You know, like, he was really, like, able to sort of, like, he's got he's got one of the best positions in all of comedy. Like, you know, just sort of like, it all depends on what I want to do.
FX has a really good... It's just a cool channel. Like, they have a really good grouping of shows. And so are the channels are splitting off,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So the main there's going to be the original FX channel, but then there's also another FX channel.
There's FX, FXX, which is where Totally Biased, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and The League are going to. Mm-hmm. And then there's FX, which is Louis, and like all the drama shows are staying on FX.
Like Justified.
And Sons of Anarchy. And then FXM... is going to be a lot of movies, but also I guess they're going to do some more miniseries.
Okay.
So yeah, I think they're just sort of, you know, I think they feel like the brand is powerful enough to split it up, and unfortunately FXX is going to take over what is formerly Fox Soccer. So sorry, soccer fans. If you'd been more thorough and watched more, you'd still have that.
Kind of your fault for not supporting.
Yeah.
But I feel like that it doesn't, you know, like the content is what draws people now. So
I feel like, you know, there's this part of this that could be like, how come we don't get to stay on the big network? But it's also like, you know, if 2 years ago somebody had said you're gonna be part of the launch of a new cable channel, I'd be like, yay! To me, it's like people find their media where they find their media. You know, ultimately, a lot of people watch our show on the internet anyway. So,
right,
you know, I haven't given a lot of thought. I'm excited to be able to try to do it every day and see what happens. Like, you know, one day a week was sort of almost killing me for 13 weeks. In the last six episodes, it was like, okay, we figured this out. So I assume it's probably going to be hard the first...
I'll tell you what. Having worked on... Because I worked on a show on G4 called Attack of the Show, and I was not... I was not on every episode of Attack of the Show, but there were definitely stretches where I would fill in hosts, so I'd be like, for 2 weeks I would do the show. And you are exhausted by the end of the week, but what is so great about it is it's just like I said before, there's no time to second guess.
Yeah.
Like, you get an idea and you go, fuck it, great, let's just do it, we'll just make it work.
Yeah, yeah, yes,
and
yes.
You do it, and you forget about it, and the next day you start all over again, and there's something really fun about that, where you don't really, your energy... that you had before in a weekly show where you're poring over every nuance and joke. Like, oh, I don't know. Should we?
Well, no, it's that thing where you write a joke on Monday and by Thursday you're like, I don't even know what this means.
Yeah. That won't happen anymore. Because you'll just like, fuck, we got to make a show.
Yeah.
No matter what happens every night, is your show going to be live?
Live to tape.
Live to tape. Okay. Yeah. So you'll probably tape it in the evening and then it'll go on later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fucking, that's great. I think that's, well, I think, you that's know, a good way to do it.
The way Chuck describes, like, nobody says, like, you think things like the New York Times. Nobody goes, yesterday's New York Times was really bad, but today's was better. Like, it's just sort of like, it just sort of exists.
Yeah.
You know, and there's parts you like and parts you don't like. But so he, like, where there's almost less pressure on each individual show. But still, I feel like the pressure is to support the brand. I would hate to think that if we started doing daily, that the brand would be, that suddenly we were doing things that we wouldn't have done. You know, that we would have thought were beneath us. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
There's a real temptation to sort of like just, I think we've built a strong brand, and I think there's some people who are really starting to respond to it. And I think the temptation would be like, I don't know, just a pie fight. You know, just, oh, we got to fill a space. Just a pie fight.
Well,
I don't know.
That you've just described Attack of the Show.
Exactly.
We'll just have Olivia jump into a cake, into a giant pie.
Although that kind of was supporting the brand, wasn't
Speaking
it?
Speaking of pie, did I notice a pie on your arm?
A pie? Oh, no, this is the 37.
No, wait a minute. That's number 37, but look.
Oh, that's funny.
If I just see this much of
that's
it,
that's funny.
That looks exactly like a pie.
I've never had that. I've never had anybody see it as that way.
When it's just the bottom of the three and the bottom of the seven,
that would have been a cooler tattoo. Instead of a 37 written in my ex-girlfriend's handwriting,
forever.
Mm-hmm. Most times I forget that part, but looking at it, like, hey, that's right. But yeah, that's funny.
You could just color in the top, and it could just be a pie.
That's sort of what Johnny Depp had to do with Winona on his... he had a Winona tattoo that now says wino. Because I like wine.
Oh, just no.
Yeah, no.
No.
Yeah,
Nona. It's Italian for grandma.
Exactly, yes.
Everyone knows that.
Everybody knows that, yeah. That's win. Win-o. Win-o.
Win-o. Winon.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
So. I guess I'll just start dating Winona Ryder again.
That's the solution.
Winona Ryder just disappeared.
Yes.
Come on, Winona Ryder.
She did. It's funny. Her and Molly Ringwald both went to this.
I've seen more of Molly Ringwald in the last few years than I have Winona Ryder.
Well, she disappeared earlier, though.
So she did.
It's ready for this. So Winona Ryder in 5 years will be back.
Do you think? I feel like she's just done. I feel like she just went through the business.
She was like one of the first people who went through the really sort of like media side of like, you know, like the whole, when she was convicted of shoplifting, and it was right when we started to become an entertainment news culture.
Right.
So that became a big story.
I remember it even went back further than that when she was dating Johnny Depp or dating like Dave Perner. You know, and it was like they'd show up to the award shows and Dave Perner would have his strategically disheveled hair.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, and it was like, oh my God, Winona Ryder's dating a bad boy. This sweetheart of our culture.
Yes. I mean, I feel like that what happened with her is a symbol. I mean, I feel like that's all connected to like Chappelle and like that thing about, I totally get that thing about like, there's those celebrities where you don't know anything about their personal life.
Right.
I think that's a really great way to do it. you don't really protect that side of yourself.
Well, it's weird because I think some of the responsibility is on the part of the famous person, because I think at an early stage they play into it because they're like, oh, look, attention, Fred. And then at a certain point, it's just like, it's, you know, like, you know, if you have a disagreement with someone and then all of a sudden in 2 seconds you're just shouting and you're like, when did this get out of control? I can't control this. I think that's probably what happens. But I remember talking to Joel McHale when he worked on that movie with Matt Damon. He goes, you don't really know much about Matt Damon. Yeah. You know he's got a kid. You know he's married.
Yeah, you know he's married.
Personally,
yeah.
you don't know much about him. He goes, we go to the airport. He just puts on a hat, keeps his head down. No one bothers him. He doesn't, you know, like, he doesn't have a publicist calling to tell people, like, he's going to show up at this place to shop because you want to be there with paparazzi. Like, there's a certain, I think there's a little bit of...
You can control versus Ben Affleck, who was like, I'm dating J-Lo.
Oh, my God. You remember that? Or music video.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to let you know everywhere I am. You know, did you see there's House of Lies?
The Don Cheadle show? Yeah.
There's an episode with Matt Damon where he's basically playing the bizarro version of Matt Damon. The guy who is, like, on the cover of everything and is really an asshole. It's really funny.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, see him skewer. Because clearly he's doing that on purpose. He's actively not being involved in all the things and being, you know, just like you said, putting the hat on and just sort of...
How important do you think... Do you have complete disdain for all of that part of our culture that sort of, like, you know, tabloid? Because I look at the tabloids and I go, okay, here's what this is. These are reality shows for really famous people, who a lot of which would never be on a reality show. I mean, Kardashians aside.
Yeah.
But, you know, this person broke up with this person and then this vacation and look at they're losing the baby weight. Like, here's some pictures from a vacation that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you know, it's funny because there's occasionally, like, because the show covers a lot of things, and sometimes, like, we started this ongoing, like, do we have to talk about Chris Brown again?
Right.
You know, I just feel like in with our show, in 21 minutes and 15 seconds, there should be enough to talk about that we shouldn't have to spend too much time talking about that stuff.
Yeah.
Not that I even, if people want to know about that stuff, there's plenty of avenues for them to go to that deal with that stuff. Sometimes that stuff does sort of veer into, you know, you want to have a take on it because it actually is a window into a bigger discussion. But how do you get into that discussion? Like with Chris Brown, there's a lot of things about that are windows into bigger discussions about how, you know, about domestic violence and, you know, those kind of things. But then how do you make that funny? I don't know. We're working on, you know, so, but, you know, it's funny. Like I remember I've been on some, I'm sure you've done a lot of those shows where they have a panel show where they just put a bunch of comics and people like throw you topics out. And sometimes it'll be like, what do you think about Lindsay Lohan? I don't know. I think she needs help.
Yeah.
I think she really needs some better people. I feel like I don't want to pile on her.
Yeah, well, the fucking tabloids is like, this bitch is crazy. Why is she so crazy?
Yes.
Well, stop poking her.
Yeah. Let her just live
her
life.
It's like hovering over an adorable puppy and then just poking him in the face. And then eventually he bites you and you're like, well, how could this happen?
Yes.
You poked him in the face 100 times.
Like, there's all this stuff, like all this Amanda Bynes. She's like pictures of her in New York walking. I was like, oh, just let her.
And now everything, she just picked up an apple. Is this weird behavior?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, she has done some weird stuff.
Yes, of course. But I feel like
putting it under a microscope is not going
to
help.
Yeah, I don't know that us talking about it is going to help, unless we're actually going to try to help her. Like, I feel like that's the thing. Like, sounds like these people need help.
And you put her in a position where anything she says, they're going to go, well, she's crazy.
Yes.
Even if she's like, hey, guys, even if tomorrow she held a press conference and said, I know it seems like I'm crazy. You know, I'm not really crazy. Oh, she's in denial.
Oh, she's claiming she's not crazy. That's the craziest crazy of all.
Do you think with comedy, do you believe that that anything is off limits, or do you feel like with comedy all bets are off as long as it's funny?
I feel like comedy, the thing that comedy can do is that it can take a difficult subject and make it easier to talk about. You know, right now, you know, yesterday I think happened in Boston that we're still sort of sorting through, like what happened with the marathon and the bombs exploding. I think comedy's job, not every comics, but there's a part of comedy is to like sift through that and go, how can we make this make a little bit of sense or take some air out of this, you know? So I think everything is able to be processed through comedy. It's just some things are harder than others.
I was supposed to perform last night and I canceled because I just couldn't. I was supposed to do the Whiplash show at UCB.
And I
felt bad because I had called I'd emailed Jeremy Levenbach and I said, hey, I'm in town. Can I pop up tonight? And he was like, sure. And then that happened. And I emailed in the middle of the day and I was like, I don't know. And he goes, well, think about it. And then in the evening, I emailed him and I was like, you know, I just feel too sad. And I knew one of two things were going to have to happen. Number one, I was either going to have to go on stage and sort of deal with it the way that I saw Geraldo do at the Comedy Cellar right after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And he did it in such a wonderful way that helped people really it was respectful, but it helped people kind of deal with how fucking freaked out everyone was.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like I'm good at that. and so I just felt like I would just go on stage and be sad, and I certainly didn't feel like I could go on stage and be like, one time I put on these crazy animal pajamas. Like, I just couldn't do it. And so I had to say, like, I'm sorry. I just can't do it.
No, I think that the best part of that is to know, I don't think we should feel like we're the Marines where we have to wade into every situation.
Right.
I think every comic has a different ability to do that. And I think on some level, sometimes, I think the thing I remember after September 11th is seeing audiences who didn't want to think about it at all and just wanted a guy to talk about animal pajamas.
Right.
You know, like, I think they were like, oh, good, he's just talking about animal pajamas.
Right.
So I think that, you know, certainly those things can be, you know, comedy can do that too. It can distract you in a healthy way, you know. So, but I don't think any subject is off limits. I do think comics can, there's a thing about, I feel like it happens to comics when they're young in their career, but also comics sometimes do the thing where they wade into situations to show how tough they are.
Right.
And I don't think that's helpful.
No. You know?
Yeah. Like, and I think...
Yeah, I'll say it. I'm not afraid. I'll say it. Is that really the best choice?
Yeah, why does that matter? You know, like, so... I mean, I feel like, you know, we just talked about the word nigger. I think a lot of comics try to throw that word around to show how tough they are. I think a lot of comics... There's a weird rape wave in comedy, like, where comics are sort of like wanting to take that on and sort of.
Well, I think that I sense that that's died down.
Yeah,
because I think it's typically more young comics.
Yes, I think that's true. I think you get to a point where you go, I can say whatever I want. I'm going to say anything.
Well, I think it's I don't even think it's about making rape jokes, to be honest with you. I think it's about a young, kind of an experienced comic on stage who is thinking, okay, I could either really try to craft a joke about something else to make people laugh, or it's this kind of punk rock place, and I think in their minds it's a punk rock place where they go, I'm going to get a reaction out of the audience.
Yes.
I'm going to shock them. So I'm just going to say something that no one else would say in front of them, or that I know that I shouldn't say in front of them, just to get a reaction, even if it's not laughter.
Yes, yes. It's searching for edge.
Yeah.
And I think that... But really, to me, it's like a baby with a shotgun. It doesn't mean it's edgy. You just want to play with all the tools. And I think that there's something valuable about trying to play with those tools. But I think when people then get offended by it, and you think the thing I hate about comedy that happens is if somebody gets offended and you call them dumb for being offended.
Right.
When again, it's like, well, no, now we're talking to a much bigger room than we used to talk to.
Right.
And people have the right to be offended by whatever they're offended by. Now, you cannot agree with their offense, but just because they're offended doesn't mean, like, to me, if you make a joke about rape that isn't actually respectful of any aspect of that issue and people get offended,
of course they're going to be offended.
Like, and just accept that.
Yeah.
Like, you still make your jokes.
Yeah.
But just accept that, you can offend people.
You have to know that if in any, even just an interpersonal situation, if you hand someone a bag of shit, that you can't always expect them to be like, thank you for this bag of shit. Exactly, and I'd be like, why did you give me this bag of shit? Oh, how can you get up so upset? Well, you gave me this.
Yes.
You had to know that this was going to go one of two ways.
And not everybody's going to be like, how edgy.
Yeah.
Be a bag of shit. This young punk rock mind.
Should put him in the movies.
Yes, yes. And I think that's the part about it that bothers me, is that if you're going to play with the sharp tools in the drawer, then don't be surprised when you cut people.
Right.
You
know, like, I think, or yourself.
Yeah, or yourself. And it's like the whole idea when shock jocks get fired and then they get upset when they get fired. Hey, you're a shock jock.
Yeah.
You shocked people. That's kind of what you're supposed to do.
You know?
So don't be surprised when that happens. So I just feel like...
I think a lot of comics outgrow that stuff.
I think that's true, but I do think that, like... There's this basic thing in comedy where it's like, where they're not basic, but I feel like a lot of times comics defend the free, like, take the free speech place. I can say whatever I want to say. Yes, you can, again.
Yeah, again.
But there's consequences sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I'm sure Brian Regan has offended somebody, you know, even though he's not talking about, you know, even though.
I'll tell you who's offended. He's offended this guy. Hey, how come that guy's always making fun of me?
Exactly.
What'd I do to him?
That guy who just happens to have that voice is offended by Brian Regan.
I don't understand. What'd I do to that guy?
Yeah, and so someone told
me to have a safe flight once, and I said you too, even though they weren't going anywhere. But why attack me?
Why bring me into it?
Come on.
Yeah, and so I feel like everybody's going to offend somebody at some point. But if you're, for example, Jim Norton, who I think handles it pretty. I think he just, this is what I do. It's more likely you're going to offend more people than Regan, you know?
Right.
And just accept that. And I'm not bringing Norton into this as somebody who hasn't done a good job of it, but I feel like, you know, just accept that you're playing with the sharp tools. I think he does accept that. But a lot of comics want to be Jim Norton, but not take the responsibility.
Right. But I think there's also... You can tell when someone's point of view is an organic extension of who they are. Mm-hmm. Or you can tell when it's like, you know, like when Howard Stern got popular and all the DJs around the country were like, they're faking it.
Yes.
They're like,
yes,
no, no, that's just who he is.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
it works because that's who he is. That's not who you are.
No, 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 no.
And
no.
So don't try to put on your big brother's coat.
Yes.
And be like, look, I'm in a gang.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, all right, yeah.
Just no, fucking.
Yes. Well, I think that is the problem, is that people are aping what other people are doing and not coming from a genuine place. And I think there's room for that. There's room for people to be that. There's room for Howard Stern. But don't expect that that's going to work for everybody.
Yeah.
You know.
I just did some shows in Madison, Wisconsin, with this comic named Josh Gondelman.
Oh yeah, I know Josh.
Yeah, he's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had great sets, and what we sort of started saying to each other before we go on stage is like, well, we're going to go out and tell our turbo truths. They're true-ish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they're, you know... We embellish,
yes,
because
yes,
it's
yes,
comedy. I mean, you yes, kind of have to take a grander. So I sort of like the idea of calling them turbo truths. Here are some turbo truths about myself.
Faster ways to get to the truth. I have to embellish the truth.
Faster,
a little bit.
Bigger. You know, yes, Steve Austin. Faster, stronger.
Yes.
But
I sort of know that there's things I say that offend people, but I accept that fact. And sometimes I feel like my whole point is that when people go, I'm offended, I go, good, you were the person I was trying to offend. You know what I mean? Like, you know, but when I offend the people I'm not trying to offend, I go, oh, maybe I should try to figure that out and do it differently. But
right.
No, offense is part of the deal, you know.
To someone, I mean, especially with what you're doing.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm not trying to be like, I'm a truth teller and a firebrand. I'm just, no, I want to take strong stances, you know?
Yeah.
That's part of what I like to do, and the comedy I like, and not just politically, but just strong stances about whatever I'm talking about. I want to be like, this is what I believe in this moment, and when you do that, you're inevitably going to offend somebody.
Do you want people to just come away laughing, or do you want them to come away laughing but be challenged, or do you care, or is that too trying to engineer it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think it's... if they don't come away laughing, it doesn't matter what else I did.
Right.
So I feel like the laughter still got to be job one. But I do want them to come away. I do want to feel like I communicated an idea to them, and then whatever they do with that idea is up to them.
Because you could sort of evolve. Like when you look at Jon Stewart,
mm-hmm,
and he started out as a comic. I mean, like if you watch Jon Stewart's early comedy, it was very much like, hey, there's a weird thing that everyone does, you know, and then he starts doing the Daily Show.
It's like a classic observational comedy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so then it sort of expanded. You know, Bill Maher was the same way. His comedy in the 80s was a lot of like, hey, isn't it weird? Like there was a little political stuff, but it was I would not have considered him a political comic.
No.
And so, you know, going down this path, do you sort of feel... And now you see, like, Jon Stewart on Bill O'Reilly, like, debating
Yes, yes.
You know, do you sort of...
I don't see myself... I think you have to have interest in doing that. I don't really ever want to debate Bill O'Reilly. I might want to talk to him, but I'm not interested in doing that thing where we sort of, like, square off.
Right.
You know, I think... I mean, they're clearly doing a dance.
Of course.
Like, you know, but I don't really feel like... the space I'm trying to claim isn't one of me against... you know, I'm the left and this is the right and blah, blah, blah. It's really a space of, like, I just want to create a space for all these other people, but I'm not, like, you know, as a political comic, do that thing where you sort of, they invite you onto political shows, and I always find myself in this weird space of, like, okay, if I say something to be funny, they think I'm disrespectful.
Right.
If I say something to be smart, I'm not as smart as the other people on this thing.
Right.
So I look stupid.
And then if you say something serious, then you're not funny.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so weird. Like, so it's weird. Win.
Like, I feel like I'm thrown into that space, but for me, it's better to be in... I just want to be in my space.
Yeah.
And spaces like these.
Where you're such an intersectional progressivist.
Yeah, that's my gimmick. They cracked my... Gallagher had the watermelons and the Sledge-O-Matic, and I have intersectional progressivism.
You know,
we all... have our bumper stickers that we're trying to sell after this.
Here's show. What I think of intersectional progressivism.
Yeah, and that way Gallagher was way more political than a lot of these other people we talked about.
I guess that's true.
Yeah, he Gallagher used to do like 45 minutes of the knuckleheads in Congress and then ended with watermelons.
Yes.
Yes.
And he really hated fruit.
Yes. He was really political about that.
That's so funny to me. That I was just talking about this movie last night when I've talked about it a bunch on the podcast before, called The Dark Backward. Have you ever seen it?
Mm-mm.
It's Judd Nelson. It's late 80s, early 90s. Basically, it's a super surreal, I guess you would call it a dark comedy.
Yes.
But he's a really bad comic. Judd Nelson's a really bad comic. And then he wakes up one morning and he basically has sprouted a third arm.
Oh, I've heard of this movie, yes.
And so he goes back to doing comedy and he tells the same horrible jokes, but then he just spins around so people can see the arm, and then they fucking lose their minds with laughter. That to me is sort of like, well, I'm going to tell you a thing I really believe in, and it was going to hit a thing.
Yes, 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 yes.
And then it becomes more about the hitting the thing, yes. Than no one gives it a really
good. People like it, just all becomes a build up to people hitting, to him hitting the thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, these idiots, those knuckleheads in Congress are crazy. When are you going to hit the thing?
We know all that.
It's all foreplay.
Well, we are at our hour.
All right.
I don't know why I said that like this was a therapy session.
No, I feel like I have a therapy
hour.
Session.
Do you feel...
I feel better.
We'll talk about some of this next week, but yeah, I really want you to go home.
I don't know what I'm going to do. 142 episodes.
Yeah. You're going to be okay, probably. Okay.
We're going to do this every week.
Every week we're going to do a therapy podcast for you.
Nice. My wife will be very happy to hear that. Yes.
Week 7, he really starts to get angry.
Week 8, nothing but tears. No, man, I'm glad to have done it.
Yeah, congratulations. I love the San Francisco comedy scene so much. I love performing in San Francisco. I think if I said I'll be at Cobb's later this year, and I'm kind of scared of it a little bit because
is that just, your first time at Cobb's?
No, I've done Cobb's before, but I don't know if I've ever headlined Cobb's because it's just like such a big room.
Yes,
it's like an airplane hangar.
It is like an airplane. It is like an airplane hangar. Yes,
but there were so many great. I mean, you must have been friends with Warren Thomas and.
Well, you know, it's funny. By the time I got there, those people would come in and out. And so I did a week with Warren Thomas. One of the strangest weeks I ever did in comedy was with Warren Thomas. Yeah. He's a great comic, but I didn't know him.
For people who don't know, Warren passed away, what, 5-6 years ago?
Yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, it was maybe longer than that. It's been a while. Yeah, I guess it was 5-6 years ago, yeah. Yeah, no, he was a comic that I saw as an example of, like, again, we were talking about how to take up the space of black, but do it in your own way.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing about Warren that felt like he wasn't black, but he certainly was doing it his own way.
Yeah. What was the weird experience you had?
Warren had a lot of demons, and so it was just I can't really confirm anything, but it was like, we worked together for a week, most of it was him in the green room with the door closed, and then his wife/manager, I guess, who was with him, and then a lot of people walking in and out of the green room, and he'd come out and do like 45 minutes. It was like different every night, and we never talked. And at the end of the week, he's like, "Hey, man, give me a hug." And I just felt like, I don't think I've said 3 words to you. All right, let's hug. You know?
One of you was like, "What do you do?" "Oh, I'm a comic. I've been opening for you."
Yeah. It was just a very funny. He never saw my sets because he'd always come late, which is fine. But it was just a funny at the end of the week. Like, give me a hug. All right. We can do that.
We'll get out. Sure.
Yeah,
why not?
Yeah.
But if you ever go to San Francisco and you want to just go to the Punchline or Cobb's, but what's fun about the Punchline in particular is that there's just this like wall of San Francisco comic fame, and so you see all these amazing. It's like, you know, you and Patton and Warren and Mitch and Dana, and
which is funny because I mean that wall existed, and then one day I came in and my face was up there, and I was like, oh wow, and this is well before the show. Like I felt like they really honored me before anybody would have known I needed to be honored.
Legendary comic W.
Legend.
No.
Yes. No.
Please, not yet. Don't put me. No.
But it was like, you know, it is. I do feel like. The one thing about being in San Francisco, I wanted to feel like when I left that they would remember that I had been there, and I feel like that happened. So, and I went back recently and did 2 shows in Oakland that were amazing, and a couple shows in San Francisco at Stageworks that people considered me to be one of the people. And I feel like a lot of times comics leave San Francisco and San Francisco doesn't know they were there. And so I didn't want to be that guy. So,
do you know what you just did for this podcast? And I want to thank you for it. And then I'm going to hug you like okay. Warren did. All right, all right. You just gave us the This American Life ending.
Oh, look at me. Look at me.
I really appreciate that.
I'm a big fan of This American Life. So
you just raised the bar a bit.
All right. Well,
I really...
we were searching for an ending and you hit This American Life button in front of me. So I was like, you know.
So we got the This American Life
ending. Well, we should probably stop talking or else.
Oh, shit. Yeah. We're going to ruin it if we continue to... So I just turn it up now?
Yeah.
Enjoy burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying, lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT. Stream free on Amazon Freevee or Prime Video.